Thank you. Be seated.
Well, I guess there's not going to be any press coverage of this. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Davenport versus Spence.
May it please the court, Brian Fisher will begin arguing for the petitioner. Petitioner will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, we are here today in this case on a very limited issue. I would address the court's attention to the chronology of events which is outlined in the petitioner's brief. On page 2 is a summary of the events prior to the filing of the statement of facts and transcript. Actually, I didn't get an opportunity to file a statement of facts or transcript with the Court of Appeals. I was able to take it down there and have it marked received. What happened in this case was, logistically, Rebecca Colson was the trial attorney. She then, after trial of the waiver of jurisdiction hearing, a certification hearing, as I will refer to it from this point forward, stayed on for appellate purposes. She filed what the transcript will show was a affidavit herself that she proposed would be the pauper's oath. Subsequently, as the appellate timetable started to run, it appears that she felt she was in over her head. She then asked Judge Ramona John, who was the presiding judge, to appoint someone else to handle the appeal. Grant Coleman was then appointed to handle the appeal. In the meantime, this pauper's oath just sat. There was a contest that was filed by the district clerk's office to this proposed pauper's oath, but nothing happened. A hearing was commenced, but ultimately no ruling was ever entered. In the meantime, the timetable for the filing of the statement of facts and transcript expired. And some 14 or 15 days after the last date for the filing of an extension of time to file the statement of facts and transcript had expired, Grant Coleman, who was the previous appellate lawyer, filed a motion to withdraw as appellate counsel in the 313th District Court in Harris County. On December 30th, then Grant Coleman's motion to withdraw was signed by Judge John, and then an order appointing me was signed. Subsequently, in the transition after the election, I was handed the packet indicating that I had been appointed to handle the appeal on January 6th. Now, there's no question I was outside the timetable for the rules for filing the statement of facts and the transcript. However, at that point, I had a hearing on the pauper's oath contest. It was overruled, and I was then authorized by the judge of the 313th District Court, Judge Shelton, to request, based upon a pauper's oath that had been upheld by the court, the statement of facts from the court reporter and the transcript. We were able to accomplish that, and on February 8th of this year, approximately 32, 33 days after I had received the appointment, I went down to the Court of Appeals with the transcript from the clerk's office and with the statement of facts, along with a motion to file them out of time. I was aware of the rules, but the fact of the matter was that I believed, because of the seriousness of the offense and that we were dealing with a certification appeal, a motion to waive jurisdiction, that my client should be entitled to an out-of-time appeal. Well, naturally, the Court of Appeals...
Could you explain the review of the certification that will occur in the adult criminal trial?
That's just it, Justice. There is no review of a certification in the adult court. That will change to a certain extent come January 1st. The legislature has addressed the very issue that I am before the court on today. The legislature has modified Section 5601 of the Family Code to provide, effective January 1st, that once the certification hearing, the motion to waive jurisdiction, has been held, and if the juvenile is certified, that Those issues that may be ripe for appeal are stayed and go with the juvenile to the adult court. And then after the adult proceeding is concluded, those issues may be raised as part of the adult proceeding under Section 44.47 of the Code of Criminal Procedure.
That's not present.
It doesn't exist at this time.
If there's some things...
Under the new statute, will there be any review as it is presently by the Court of Appeals and apparently?
What will happen on cases after January 1st is that the issues on certification will be raised as part of the criminal appeal, which means that then the juvenile respondent will be entitled to an out-of-time appeal under the rules, because it will then be part of the criminal appellate procedure and go through the Court of Appeals and on to the Court of Criminal Appeals across the street. So the very issue that
I'm... There will no longer be an interlocutory appeal.
Correct. Okay. There will not.
Counsel, the Juvenile Justice Code, which was signed by the governor, appears to have a retroactivity provision that might apply to this case. Have you looked into that?
I have not, Your Honor. I don't know whether or not it will apply. But I think the court can take notice of a case that, in fact, came out in the most recent Southwest Second, and that is the matter of MRR, which is at 903 Southwest Second 49, which appears basically to track the tenets of my brief. In that case, the Court of Appeals out of San Antonio found that counsel's failure to file a statement of facts may operate to deny the defendant, in this case, or respondent in our case, opportunity at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner to present the appeal. In this case, the appellate counsel didn't file a statement of facts timely, didn't file a request for extension of time timely, and in the opinion in MRR, the Court of Appeals cites Evitz versus Lucy, which is a case from the Supreme Court that I've cited to this court regarding ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal, and also cites as well Griffin versus People of Illinois, as well as citing the two Supreme Court cases of In re Galt and Kent versus the United States. In essence, then, what...
Mr. Fisher, before you go on, in essence, the bottom line is you're claiming that both Rebecca Colson and Grant Coleman were ineffective counsel that denied your client an appeal.
That is exactly the case, Judge.
In a civil proceeding.
That is correct.
Where there's no right to counsel on appeal, even in a criminal case.
Well, there's a statutory right.
There is, under Section 56 of the Texas Family Code. And the matter of MRR out of the Court of Appeals, which was rendered on May 17, 1995, addresses that very issue, and then cites in conjunction...
There's a statutory right, so it would be clear, under the Family Code for juveniles to an
Section
attorney.
Section 56.
To an attorney.
Correct. On appeal.
There is no constitutional claim to a right to counsel in a appeal of criminal cases.
It's in an appeal of criminal cases?
Right.
Well, I think Evitz versus Lucy says that there is a constitutional right to counsel on appeal in a criminal case, and that's a United States Supreme Court case. And, of course, we allege also that in addition to Section 56, as recited in MRR, MRR also recites the fact that the Sixth Amendment provides for a necessity for effective assistance of counsel. And they cite the Sixth Amendment, and of course in our brief we cite the 14th Amendment.
Is there a constitutional right to a juvenile be having a meaningful opportunity to proceed in a civil proceeding as opposed to a criminal proceeding?
That is what the Court of Appeals in San Antonio has said in the case of MRR.
And that's as high as authority as there is at this point.
That's why I'm here, Justice. And that's why I bring MRR to the Court's attention, because obviously the attorney for MRR, Mr. Bartolome, and I were thinking along the same lines. I didn't have an opportunity to speak with him, but when I read this case in conjunction with the brief that I filed, it would appear that we were thinking exactly along the same lines. I was unable to find a case in point until MRR.
What is the policy ground? For those of us who haven't read MRR, we've only known about it before, what's the best policy ground that this does rise to a constitutional
Do we open the floodgates, I guess, is the biggest question. The policy grounds that MRR found and that we allege in our brief in conjunction with the U.S. Supreme Court cases is, and Mr. Delmore has argued in his response brief, the balancing test. Certifications of concur are not adjudications of delinquency, nor are they adjudications of guilt or innocence. However, it has been found in Ray Galt that this is a critical step in the litigation process for a juvenile.
But it's never been critical enough to say that there's a constitutional due process right to counsel.
Until I appear before you this morning, it hasn't been addressed.
So what other rules of civil procedure or appellate procedure would be threatened in a juvenile proceeding by the application of the principle that you argue for here?
Well, the standard rules of civil appellate procedure apply to juvenile proceedings. And what happened with respect to MRR is they found, under the theory that a juvenile proceeding is quasi-civil, quasi-criminal, and that there are specific protections in Title III of the Family Code that address the criminal protective rights for a juvenile, that in reading Title III in conjunction with the theory that it is a quasi-civil, quasi-criminal proceeding, then in MRR, the court applied the rules of appellate procedure that allow for an out-of-time appeal. And I suggested to the Court of Appeals that in this limited case, and now, of course, in conjunction with the legislature's codification of the right to an out-of-time appeal, I suggested to the Court of Appeals in this case that they have the opportunity to follow the rules of appellate procedure whereby they could have a determination by the trial court in a hearing as to whether or not there was ineffective appellate assistance of counsel. What happens in the criminal side, as Mr. Delmore is well aware, is that the Court of Appeals can take the case and can make a determination upon the filing of the transcript and statement of facts whether or not there's good cause to allow the out-of-time appeal. Or if there's a question, they can remand that issue to the trial court for a hearing as to whether or not there was ineffective appellate assistance of counsel. And then that trial court can send a statement of facts to the Court of Appeals for review, upon which they can make a determination as to whether there's good cause for an out-of-time appeal.
That's the only basis for a late filing of the transcript and statement of facts, is it not?
On the criminal side.
On any side. And is there any, do you make any constitutional argument that there should be more basis for that?
Do I?
Yes.
Yes, I do, Justice. My argument is based upon the 14th Amendment. That is the application of equal protection of the law, both to the juvenile as well as to the adult.
But the adult only has it if counsel has been ineffective. And what I'm asking is there any other way to get the transcript and the statement of facts there late other than by showing ineffective assistance of counsel?
Not to my knowledge.
And you don't argue for one in this case?
I do not. And therein may be the remedy for this court in ruling on this case to narrow the opinion to the extent that they have in MRR that where there is a finding that there was ineffective appellate assistance of counsel, which has denied the juvenile the opportunity to have the issues raised, that you can limit that opinion to that extent. And I suspect that that would be narrow enough to close the floodgates.
Is there any floodgate if this is going to be cured by statute in 3 months?
I suspect that there may be some cases out there. I don't know how many. I am speaking September 13th on this very issue and supplying forms in Harris County to the juvenile law section so that anyone who follows me will have the proper forms and the timetable so that this doesn't occur within the window that we have for the next 3 or 4 months.
In a supplemental brief, would you brief the question of retroactivity, whether or not the changes in the juvenile?
I did not, Justice.
Well, will you do it in supplemental brief?
Certainly, I'd be glad to.
Respondent makes an argument that somehow you've waived some of your arguments. The respondent suggests that you have not raised and argued the denial of the statutory right to counsel on appeal, and you focus basically on constitutional rights versus statutory rights, and that somehow you've waived your rights under the family code.
Mr. Delmore and I have worked together on cases in the past, and I respect Mr. Delmore greatly. But the problem that exists there is that my client has had appellate counsel. He hasn't been denied appellate counsel. He's been denied effective assistance of appellate counsel. And therein is the difference.
What did the two prior counsel fail to do that they should have done?
What they should have done was, first of all, they should have filed a proper pauper's oath. In the juvenile courts, the standard procedure in Harris County, Texas, is that you file an application for appointment as appellate counsel. You file a pauper's oath by the juvenile respondent. You file a pauper's oath by a parent or parents, because we're dealing with a child who ostensibly can't contract for himself. And if the child has no assets, the parents under Title III of the Family Code can be held responsible for court costs, attorney's fees, and the like.
None of that was done.
None of that was done. What happened was is Ms. Colson filed a nebulous notice of appeal and her own affidavit saying that the juvenile was indigent. The district clerk's office filed a contest to that affidavit. And there was some confusion as to whether or not, at least in the trial court level, that elevated that affidavit of Ms. Colson's to the level of a valid pauper's oath. After the timetable for filing a valid pauper's oath had passed, she then filed a pauper's oath signed by the respondent. There was a hearing commenced, then recessed by Judge Lowry as a visiting judge, then recommenced, then recessed, and then I believe it was the 23rd of November of last year, there was a docket sheet entry that the hearing was recessed and then nothing else happened.
What did Mr. Coleman fail to do that he should have done the second lawyer?
Mr. Coleman subsequently was appointed and did nothing. Absolutely nothing.
He could have filed a motion for extension of time.
Certainly. He could have filed a motion for extension of time because he was appointed within that 15-day window. He did not. He needed to file one both for the transcript and the statement of facts, and he neglected to do either. And then 14 days outside of the 15-day window for the filing of a motion for extension of time, he filed a motion to withdraw in the trial court, which was granted the next day.
Ordinarily, the rules of, I believe, disciplinary procedure require attorneys and courts not to relieve counsel of duties if they're going to prejudice the rights of those that they represent. How is it possible for the judge who appointed the second lawyer to allow that lawyer, Coleman, to withdraw and prejudice the rights of the accused?
That's a mystery to me, Justice. And what happened was, is that after the elections, the transition date was between December 30th and January 1st. When I walked into the courtroom on January 6th, the clerk literally handed me a photocopy of the trial court's file with an order appointing me as appellate counsel. In my review of the trial court's file, I then discovered that Judge John had granted the motion to withdraw that was filed by Mr. Coleman. And of course, in my review of the court file, I then immediately discovered that we were outside the timetable.
Was the first counsel ever relieved of duties? Did she file a motion to withdraw? And
I don't recall seeing one in the file.
Well, I haven't not been able to find one.
I don't recall seeing one in the file, but there was, and frankly, Justice, the procedure is now being cleaned up in Harris County with respect to removal of counsel and appointment of counsel. Historically, what has happened over the course of the past 17 years that I've practiced there is that a docket sheet change was made to the extent that the appointed counsel who was on the case would have the name scratched out and the new counsel's name would be written in below that on the docket sheet. Now, in Harris County, we have formal motions to withdraw, formal motions for substitution, which I am likewise attaching as forms to the topic that I speak on next month.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. William Delmore will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, the more I've considered this issue, the more it seems to me that there's a possibility that the application for writ of error was improvidently granted. There are two statutes, only one cited in my brief. I've since found a separate section of the Family Code that permits a juvenile right to counsel during any appeal from the juvenile court's waiver of jurisdiction. Both 5110A and 5601C both provide that the juvenile has a statutory right to counsel. There are also provisions such as, I think it's 5109, that says that a juvenile can't waive rights like adult litigants can without additional procedural safeguards.
Doesn't this cut against your counsel?
Well,
because you have, what good is counsel or attorneys if they're not going to do anything, like the second attorney who could have filed a motion for extension of time? It's a hollow right. You have a statutory right to counsel if the lawyer's not going to do anything.
My point is, though, that the statutory right to counsel was never suggested to the Court of Appeals. Instead, this court's being asked to make a rather significant and remarkable extension of federal constitutional due process law when there's a possibility that a much more limited holding could have resulted in the relief that's being sought by this petitioner.
Why is this any broader than Kent? We have a statute, we have a right, we have a lawyer, and now all we have to do is say, if you got all that, due process says it's got to be effective.
Well, I think that if you compare Kent to In re Galt, which are the two major cases that both sides are relying on, you can see that a similar distinction was made by the Supreme Court of the United States in that they were reluctant to extend the full panoply of federal due process rights to a discretionary transfer hearing when they were more than willing to do that with regard to a hearing to adjudicate delinquency in Galt.
But we don't have to do it either because the legislature has already decided to get a lawyer. And now our only question is there some constitutional requirement that that lawyer be effective?
And I'm suggesting that it's not necessary to reach that constitutional issue because there was independent statutory basis that hasn't been raised. This court hasn't been asked to rule upon it.
Those statutes would require an effective counsel or just a counsel?
Well, I'm looking at the statute that gives them a right to counsel in conjunction with the statute that says that juveniles can't waive their rights by inaction. You have to have additional safeguards with regard to an effective waiver by a juvenile, and perhaps there'd be room to hold that you cannot waive your right to counsel by inaction, that your counsel cannot waive your right for you,
and you say we
by
have
his
no,
negligence.
We would have no authority to make a holding based on a statute that's in the books if counsel has only asked for the identical relief under the Constitution.
It depends on how limited you want to view the application for writ of error and the issue that's before the court. I would suggest that since this issue may never arise again, in light of the fact that the legislature has essentially solved the problem for us by the enactment of the new Juvenile Justice Code, this court may wish to be reluctant to make a major constitutional extension of federal due process rights for the benefit of one litigant.
Why do we need to get into the Constitution at all? Why can't we just say that the Family Code, when it says right to counsel, means effective counsel, not just somebody with a bar card?
I think you could hold, yes, that the juvenile's right to counsel on appeal was not effectively waived by his attorney's inaction. And I would prefer that to a major constitutional issue. The problem is that argument has never been made to this court. It's never been briefed. It wasn't made in the court below. And ordinarily, this court's function is a court of review. And I don't know if you can review an issue that was never adequately raised in any manner, in any court, prior to this argument today or in the respondent's brief. This court is general mandate is to serve as the custodian of Texas jurisprudence rather than to correct individual errors that may have occurred in individual cases. And I think that what we're basically here today on is an individual error, statutory error, that may never again arise.
Mr. Delmore, have you looked into the retroactivity provisions of the revisions to the Juvenile Justice Code?
Yes, I have.
How that impacts this case?
Yes, I have. My reading of the effective date provision of House Bill 327, I think it is that none of the amendments will be effective to any cases that pertain to offenses committed before January 1st, 1996. My reading of the effective date provision is that the trial, that all proceedings pertaining to offenses committed prior to January 1st, 1996 will be controlled by the law existing at the time of the offense.
Well, there is a retroactivity provision that provides some protection or some extension of rights retroactively.
Well, no, I believe that what it's saying is that the amendments, the change in procedure accomplished by those amendments are only going to be effective to offenses committed after January 1st, and that we can't use the new law to establish the procedures for offenses committed before the effective date. In other words, since this offense was committed long before January 1st, 1996, this individual will not receive the benefit of the appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals, or actually the Court of Appeals, and eventually the Court of Criminal Appeals, after any criminal conviction that may occur. Otherwise, I would say that this issue is not right, because he will be able to obtain a review of any error that occurred in the discretionary waiver hearing during his subsequent appeal. But he's not going to be able to do that because these amendments are not effective to his offense.
So if we were to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, in essence, despite the fact that he had ineffective counsel at the transfer hearing, there would be no appellate review on the transfer hearing. Is that the bottom line?
Yes, and I don't think that violates the Constitution of the United States, because the Constitution of the United States, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment made applicable to the states through the 14th, has never said that you cannot enforce and strictly enforce appellate timetables against civil litigants. I think that the exception to that general rule is based entirely upon the considerations that apply only to substantive adjudications that result in a deprivation of liberty of adult criminal defendants, and that those concerns are not applicable to a discretionary transfer hearing in which there is no adjudication of substantive rights.
Well, you keep saying strictly civil, and I understand that's what the family code says, but In re Galt and Kemp and others have said these are quasi-criminal, quasi-civil.
Well, again,
and some juveniles are entitled to some rights that criminal defendants do have.
In re Galt, that was a delinquency proceeding in which the juvenile's guilt of delinquent conduct was being adjudicated with the potential of his deprivation of liberty as a result of whatever actions the court takes subsequent to adjudicating his guilt. That's the case in which the Supreme Court of the United States held that you have the full benefit of the array of due process rights that are accorded criminal defendants, adult criminal defendants. The Kent case, though, is like this, discretionary transfer hearing, and they declined to extend the full array of due process rights to the juvenile in the waiver of jurisdiction hearing because it's not as serious and substantive a proceeding as the adjudication of guilt.
And they didn't need to.
Because there was a statute.
And there's a statute here.
True.
And the statute might solve the problem.
It well might. If
it had only been raised and argued.
That's correct, Your Honor. I've not been able to find one single case from any jurisdiction in which the right to effective assistance of counsel on appeal has been extended to a litigant in any proceeding other than an adult criminal proceeding. So what you're being asked to do is a pretty substantial leap of constitutional law. I think that that the issue in determining whether you ought to do that is this more like a criminal proceeding or more like a civil proceeding? It's more like a civil proceeding because the juvenile court was not adjudicating guilt. It was not sentencing to any kind of confinement or determining that somebody should be handled as a delinquent child. It was merely determining whether it should waive its jurisdiction. That's a civil matter.
What are the elements that are required to be found in so doing?
In the discretionary transfer hearing, Your Honor, it's a very vague standard. The court is directed to consider the background of the youth, the circumstances and severity of the offense, and determine whether, in light of those factors, the welfare of the community requires transfer to criminal court.
And what happens to the juvenile if there's no transfer?
If there is no transfer?
No certification.
Then he would either be tried as a juvenile to determine whether he had engaged in delinquent conduct, which has a number of different options as a result. He could receive probation or he could be confined in the Texas Youth Commission. Or, under our new indeterminate sentencing provisions, you could present it to a grand jury, have a grand jury certify that the case is an appropriate one for indeterminate sentencing, or is it determinate sentencing? I'm sorry. Determinate sentencing, and he could receive a sentence for up to 40 years.
It would not be a capital crime if the court were to decide not to certify. It means facing a capital crime versus not facing a capital crime. In this case?
In either instance, the offense would probably be described as a capital murder. He does not face the death penalty in either the criminal adult court or the juvenile court. In the adult court, he would be looking at a mandatory sentence of life in prison. In the juvenile court, I think that the maximum he could receive upon a determinate sentencing would be 40 years, first in a juvenile facility, and eventually he'd be transferred to an adult criminal court. But those are issues that were not determined. In this trial, in this hearing or proceeding, it wasn't really a trial. The court merely found that based on a fairly quick review of the circumstances of the offense and the circumstances of this offender, that it was going to decline to exercise any jurisdiction. It was going to decline to adjudicate any substantive rights. And that is not the sort of criminal proceeding and loss of liberty that the Supreme Court has found necessitates, as the Supreme Court of the United States has found and necessitates, this full extent of adult criminal rights.
Counsel, the Family Code provides that this petitioner is entitled by statute to an attorney. How does that differ from the Code of Criminal Procedure that provides adults the rights to an attorney for an appeal?
I don't think it differs at all. Although there are statutes that pertain to provision of attorneys to criminal defendants, all of the litigation that's arisen regarding the effectiveness of their counsel has all been constitutionally based. It's never been statutorily based. This individual will receive every aspect of due process that we've ever dreamed up during the subsequent criminal prosecution.
Except no appellate review of the transfer hearings.
Yes.
But you don't, do not deem that as substantial?
I don't deem it particularly substantial because, first, I think we can presume that the juvenile court did fully and fairly review the circumstances and determine it was appropriate to waive his jurisdiction. And second, he will receive all of the due process rights that both our statutes and constitutions provide during the subsequent prosecution.
But if an appellate court who reviewed the transfer proceedings and found them, and there was a reverse, there would be a big difference between the penalties as a juvenile as an adult. So for you to say that there's no substantial rights that have been abridged here, it seems to be a big stretch.
That seemed to be the way that the Supreme Court of the United States found a difference between discretionary transfer hearings and substantive adjudications of guilt as delinquent conduct. So that's what I'm relying upon, is the fact that the Supreme Court found it unnecessary to extend full due process rights in the context of a waiver of jurisdiction.
We would not need to say that a juvenile defendant has the full penalty of criminal rights. All we say is that he's entitled to effective assistance of counsel under the statute.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question, though.
It is not necessary to declare an opinion that a juvenile defendant has the full penalty of rights. We only have to say that he's entitled to one right, and that is, by statute, he's entitled to an effective assistance of counsel.
Yes, I'm inclined to agree with that. If the issue is properly before the court, I really don't have a problem with the individual having effective assistance of counsel during an appeal that up till now has been statutorily provided for. I wish that he had had effective assistance of counsel. I wish Mr. Fisher had represented him from the outset so we would have gotten over this hurdle and gotten on with the other proceedings.
Which I take our stay while we're waiting on this.
As I mentioned in the respondent's brief, there's some case law that indicates that the pendency of the interlocutory appeal from the waiver of juvenile jurisdiction does not stay the criminal proceedings.
And I was just asking, are they or aren't they?
I don't know, Your Honor. They may be going so far as to entertain motions to suppress evidence, that type of preliminary proceedings, but I seriously doubt if they're proceeding with the trial, which was one argument that I had prior to the abolition of this interlocutory appeal, which was if you give the juvenile a right to not just assistance of counsel, but a constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel during the interlocutory appeal, his subsequent efforts to reinstate an appeal that's dismissed because of the untimely filing of a statement of facts or transcript, or brief, for that matter, would cause great uncertainty on the part of the criminal court as to whether it should proceed with the criminal trial. Now, that concern may have resulted in the legislature's action in abolishing the interlocutory appeal and eliminating the uncertainty on the part of the criminal court as to whether it should proceed while these issues of effective assistance of counsel on appeal are out there, at least in the abstract, available to the individual. So the last thing I want to say, I noticed that my time's almost up, is that even if you should find that this petitioner was denied some statutory or constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel on appeal, I would note that the Court of Criminal Appeals in criminal cases has found that the appropriate remedy depends on what the particular failure was on the part of the appellate counsel. If it goes to a jurisdictional element, such as the filing of a notice of appeal, the Court of Appeals still has no ability or authority to consider the appeal. If, however, the untimely filing or other error goes to a non-jurisdictional matter, such as the timely filing of the statement of facts, then the Court of Appeals does have the authority to accept the statement of facts. In this case, because the Court of Appeals correctly construed the rules of appellate procedure and found that it had absolutely no authority to accept the transcript, it had no discretion but to dismiss the appeal, and the remedy would be to institute an application, a habeas corpus proceeding to get an out-of-time appeal.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Fisher, would you pick up there where Mr. Delmore's last comment? Why isn't, rather than either hold that 54A is unconstitutional as applied to this case, or in the alternative, hold that the family code's provision that the juvenile is entitled to an attorney means effectiveness of counsel, why isn't habeas corpus the appropriate remedy?
Well, the problem with that, Justice, is that within the time frame that I was working, and as addressed by MRR out of San Antonio, it appeared to me that the proper remedy at that time was to get the statement of facts and transcript before the court, because my application to the Court of Appeals was to parallel the rule applied to adult criminal cases. There is a vehicle there that the Court of Appeals uses routinely in adult criminal appeals. And in fact, in MRR, the Court of Appeals in San Antonio said, let's do that. Specifically in MRR, which I have given a copy to Mr. Delmore this morning, that court says, acknowledging that Rule 83 does not allow the Court of Appeals to consider a late statement of facts absent a timely motion for extension, they then go on to say that we must harmonize the statute and the rules, talking about Section 56 of the Family Code. And specifically Section 56, which deals with the appointment of counsel on appeal, doesn't specifically address the issue of appointment of effective assistance of counsel. Mr. Delmore accurately points out to the court that all of the cases in the criminal realm dealing with effective assistance of counsel talk about constitutional rights under the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments. We urge the same position here with this court. They go on to say that we must harmonize the statute and rules if possible. They cite the fact that since juvenile proceedings are quasi-criminal, one way to attempt this would be to construe this as a criminal case under Rules 53M and 83. 53M is the vehicle that allows the Court of Appeals to make inquiry into effective or ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and allow for the filing of out-of-time appeals. The Court of Appeals from San Antonio then goes on to say that in the present case, counsel did not file a request for extension and did not even file an affidavit of ability to pay cost until 10 days after the deadline for filing an extension. Very analogous to the fact scenario here. Based upon counsel's failure to timely file the affidavit of inability or a request for extension, we find that refusing to consider the statement of facts would deprive the appellant of effective assistance of counsel. And they cite Ward versus the State of Texas.
In the on the criminal side, the rule allowing the out-of-time appeal, was that changed by the new statute?
No. The rule remains intact with respect to criminal appeals. What has changed is that juvenile respondents who undergo a certification proceeding, a motion to waive jurisdiction, now are accorded the opportunity to appeal all certification issues as part of their adult criminal proceeding.
But what I'm curious, there has been criticism of the delays in the criminal appellate process. And generally, under the present rules, those delays are allowed in the court of appeal. And there's no change in that. There can be an untimely appeal that
We don't have interlocutory appeals on the criminal side.
I know, I'm talking about the appeal of the criminal conviction.
Has there been any effort by the legislature to expedite the appellate process for criminal cases? I don't know specifically whether or not there has. From the standpoint of what I've experienced in the other juvenile cases I have in Harris County, the courts are attempting to expedite the hearing of those cases. I can only anticipate that the change in the statute with respect to certification will certainly expedite the process of those.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court would invite any supplemental briefing on retroactivity within the next 2 weeks.
Thank you,
Justice. That concludes the argument in this clause. All the calls that we've heard this morning are heard on briefs and oral arguments, therefore submitted. And we'll ask the marshal to adjourn the court.
The argument complete, rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.